Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow, mad cow, line dance song.
Hey, Sun Gang Nation, welcome to the show. Afternoon, Sun Guy and QT with you like usual. Some show notes if you're looking for some professional wrestling in the next couple of days. Tonight, WCWO like usual at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. PWA in Courtney, B.C. APW in Royston, Georgia. SCW in Moni, Illinois. CTW in Hammond, Indiana. EPW in Midvale, Utah tonight. Tomorrow night, up in our neck of the woods, SCW in Bremerton, Washington, featuring the return of Kelly Klein. You have MCW in Baltimore, Maryland, PWA in Port Hardy, B.C., PWR in San Jose, California, FEW in Coral Springs, Florida, NGCW in Kissimmee, Florida, NLW in Godley, Illinois, ICW in Boone, Iowa, BCW in Baltimore, Maryland, NFW in Evansville, Indiana, RAPW in Struthers, Ohio, and DCW in Grapevine, Texas. Well, QT, I believe it is time to call our guest for this week. Big time guest this week, QT.
Okay, this is not going to be a collect call, is it?
I hope not.
Before you
call. All right, here we go, and let's see. Yes. Hopefully you don't send him a bill for the call either.
That would.
All right, here we go.
Yes. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Evan Ginsberg. This is Sign Guy and QT over at Turnbuckle Turmoil Radio. Thank you for taking time to be on the show here today.
My pleasure.
Well, since today's your first time on the show, we're going to give you our first-timer question to start things. What led to you getting involved in the professional wrestling industry?
Well, I was... it's kind of a long story, but I was unemployed around 1990, and I was bored out of my mind, and I started doing an early wrestling sheet, and from there, that got me into radio, because the host of one of the radio shows on WBAI-FM, a 50,000-watt station in New York, happened to be a wrestling fan who read my sheet. And he invited me. His name was Fred Geobold. And so I kind of went from an early wrestling newsletter to a 50,000-watt New York City radio station in the course of a year. And what I learned from that is one thing always leads to another. So it's always good to have your hand in different things.
When you started off with the newsletter and the radio, did you have any type of media background previously, or was this sort of new territory for you?
Well, I was a writing major in college, and I always loved writing and the arts, so there was a connection. And I had been a wrestling fan since 1972, started attending in 74. The first match I ever saw live was Freddie Blassie and Nikolai Volkoff against Bruno and Chief J. Strongbow at the Garden, June of 74. So, and I had written for various sheets prior before starting my own. The newsletters were really the predecessors of the, you know, wrestling websites and such. So I was an early wrestling sheet guy.
Fast forwarding several years, you have worked on some films related to professional wrestling. Probably the most noted one for wrestling fans would be The Wrestler from a few years ago, starring Mickey Rourke. What led to you getting involved in helping produce some films that are about wrestling?
I was an agent for various legendary wrestlers, and I was at an appearance with Luscious Johnny Valiant from the Valiant Brothers, a WWE Hall of Famer, and Nikolai Volkoff. And they were signing autographs at a wrestling store in Queens. And the executive producer, his buddy, his best friend, happened to come to the autograph signing. And we all started talking, and we hit it off. And he invited us down to meet with Darren Aronofsky, the director of The Wrestler. And you know, to make a long story short, ultimately I was hired as the associate producer, which basically I was the wrestling guy. I brought in, I did five or six casting calls, bringing in about 150 different wrestlers. I brought in Necro Butcher. I brought in Ron Killings, who was briefly in the film. Romeo Roselli was briefly in the film. All the guys in the locker room, not all the guys, the vast majority of them. Arthur ended up training Mickey, and some of his guys were there as well. But for the most part, I was the wrestling guy. I brought in the ring, Mickey's stunt double, et cetera, so on.
Now, throughout the entire history of professional wrestling, pro wrestlers have transitioned into acting, be it guest appearances on sitcoms, be it in roles for movies, regardless if it's a wrestling movie or not. Wrestlers have often done work in films. In your opinion, just as a general rule, who would you say are some of the very best wrestlers that transitioned into acting?
Terry Funk has done many movies. The Rock, obviously. Cena, as of late. Mike Mazurki, an old school wrestler, was in a ton of movies. You know, what Johnny Valiant had said to me, Johnny Valiant's an actor as well. He was on The Sopranos. He had a reoccurring part. What Johnny Valiant said to me was the wrestlers in general are far more charismatic than the actors. And wrestlers are larger than life. Wrestlers are large in general. And the average actor, you put a pair of sunglasses on them, and you know, a guy could walk down a crowded New York street and you wouldn't notice him. If The Rock walked down the street, you're going to notice him. You know, some people just have that charisma and, you know, the physical look to them, and the wrestlers are naturals. I mean, you know, a wrestler in the ring is, you know, for the most part acting. You're the heel, you're the face, whatever the case may be, and, you know, you're portraying a role, and, you know, you're telling a story in the ring. I was just watching Honor Rising on New Japan World, and, you know, they're playing a role, and they're tremendous performers, and, you know, physically and as far as their acting ability. And it's just a natural to go from wrestling to acting if you have the doors open for you.
You're currently working on a new film called 350 Days, and this looks to be a bit of a different type of movie than what The Wrestler was. Can you tell us a little bit about this project you're doing?
Sure. I'm the associate producer on a full-length documentary called 350 Days, and the title refers to back in the 1980s when the first WrestleMania and the Rock and Wrestling connection hit. these guys were literally on the road 350 days a year, and this is a very heartfelt and serious documentary on what being on the road 350 days will do to your body, your mind, your family, your marriage, your relationship with your children, your social life, et cetera, so on, because it's not a natural, you know, way to live. It's a rock and roll kind of lifestyle, being in a different town every night. Some of these guys wrestle twice in one day. They do a matinee and wrestle at night, and, you know, the toll this took on many of them. And the stars of the movie are Bret Hart and superstar Billy Graham. And many of the we've been working on it for 5 years. It's finally about to be released. The Wrestler took 7 years. People have no idea what goes into making a movie. And you know, we have guys in the movie that are gone now. George the Animal Steele, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, Larry Sharp. Many of the guys in the movie are no longer with Ox Baker, etc., so on. So not only is it a quality film, it also captures a lot of these guys in their very last interviews.
Now, when you work with some of the legends in wrestling, guys, not only from 350 Days, which is a documentary, but when you work with guys like Luscious Johnny V, and you work with guys that had been around for quite a while, like in The Wrestler, do you find it easier to work with those guys opposed to some of the newer wrestlers when it comes to making movies?
Well, you know, the legends, what people have to understand is a guy like Johnny Valiant has wrestled in front of sultans in Saudi Arabia 3 a.m. They've wined and dined with kings and queens. You know, they've had extraordinary stories. Butcher Paul Vachon, you know, wrestled the great Gama in India in front of over 100,000 people. These guys have had experiences that a lot of the younger indie guys have never had and may never have. Wrestlers are people. I mean, some of the indie guys are incredibly talented and charismatic as well. I support the indies, and, you know, it's just sometimes the older guys, the legends, have better stories to tell. They've been around longer and done more, and some of the younger guys may be the superstars of tomorrow. And I'm not using the WWE version of superstar. I mean literally superstars. So, you know, to make a long story short, the old school guys have more stories to tell, let's put it that way.
You referenced that you support the independents. Obviously, wrestling in the last 25, 30 years did a dramatic shift. We went from a territorial system where there were full-time wrestling territories that guys could work 7 nights a week if they wanted in the different territories, stay in the same area for 6 months to a year and move on. Now in the independents, it's completely different where there's not a ton of full-time work, even though it's starting to get better in that regard in the recent past. But what do you think the major differences are, both pro and con, in having the territorial system versus the independent system?
You have 3 hours? Okay. In the territorial system, guys could go down to a territory for, let's say, a year, make good money, be on top, okay? Then when things start to cool down, they'd move to the next territory and the next territory. Many of the stars that I saw in New York headlined in L.A. or Florida or Georgia or wherever. I mean, throughout the many, many, many territories. and Ivan Koloff, who main evented Madison Square Garden 13 times and defeated Bruno Sammartino back when the belt meant something. He was a main event guy in all the territories. So you can make a living, a good living, moving from territory to territory. Today, the indie guys, unless they're that rare exception like a Cody Rhodes or the Young Bucks, they can't make a living at it. They're getting paid next to nothing. And, yeah, sure, you could print up some T-shirts and sell some gimmicks and, you know, supplement your income, but most of them are weekend warriors and have a day job, and, you know, they wrestle Friday night, Saturday night, whatever the case may be, but they're just not paying the bills with it. And, you know, it's a shame that McMahon has greedily, you know, basically destroyed the territories because the WWE wants it all. But what's the good side of it all? Like I mentioned before, I'm sitting here in the comfort of my living room watching New Japan World for $8 and change a month, watching some of the finest wrestling in the world. Ring of Honor is starting a streaming service. You know, you could watch quality wrestling from here to tomorrow in the comfort of your living room live or at your convenience. What's been interesting is in a place like New York, we've gotten British promotions, we've gotten Lucha promotions. New York is multicultural and a media capital of the world. So, you know, I could travel 10 minutes from my house and go see great British wrestlers or Mexican luchadors and, you know, for $20 or whatever the case may be. And, you know, it's a golden age of wrestling in that sense where, you know, and even your basic mom and pop indie and 95% plus of them do not make money. You can have a great time, great time. To me, going to the Elks Lodge on Queens Boulevard in Queens, New York, where ECW ran out of, you know, I could see different indies almost, I would say, 2 out of 4 weekends in Queens and, you know, or Long Island or wherever the case may be close by. There's probably 5 or 6 shows every Saturday night in my geographic area and just, you know, have a beer and hang out and be amongst friends and see some quality wrestling mixed with some green guys and mixed with some guys who shouldn't be near a ring. But you have a good time, $10, $15, $20. It's a cheap night out. WWE's not cheap anymore. WWE at Madison Square Garden is like $25 to $135 a ticket. Start taking 2 kids and your wife to, you know, a WWE house show, and, you know, you've burned through $500 or whatever the case may be by the time you're done with food and gimmicks and tickets. So, you know, you go to a little indie show and you get 3 hours of live entertainment and you threw down $20 for a ticket, it's one of the best entertainment bargains out there, along with minor league baseball, if you will. There's not a lot of live sporting events that cost next to nothing that are worth seeing. So even indie wrestling on its lowest level is a lot of fun, and the kids meet the wrestlers and get autographs and pictures with them, which you wouldn't experience at a WWE show. And WWE is good for the spectaculars like WrestleMania, you know, where it feels important and there's celebrities and such, but it's, you know, wildly overpriced and, you know, it should be good for the money they charge. So I have very mixed emotions about WWE, but I urge everybody to go to the indies, go to Ring of Honor, go to Impact, go to, you know, whoever's in town and support them. It's a fun night out. And, yeah, it's always going to be a mixed bag, any indie show, especially if they have the ticket sellers on them, some of whom really shouldn't be in the ring. But for the most part, you know, it's fun. It's just fun. You know, some people in the quote-unquote internet wrestling community, they're almost too serious with this. You know, they overanalyze it, and, you know, they're critiquing everything, you know, every move of every match of every pay-per-view, and it's not all that urgent. Sometimes wrestling is just a good time out. And well, I'll be – I actually do an in-ring gimmick. I work with a heel wrestler named Simply Splendid, Bobby C., and he does a Gorgeous George-type gimmick, and he has an entourage with a butler and a maid, and I play the chauffeur, and it's a blast. You know, it's a blast just being in the ring and having fun and, you know, antagonizing the crowd and, you know, getting out alive. So I happen to love the art of pro wrestling. It's the proletarian performance art, theater for the people, and good guy, bad guy, and tell a story. And, you know, it is what it is, for better and for worse.
You brought up a little bit ago about New Japan World, and New Japan has picked up a lot of ground with wrestling fans here in the United States in the last couple of years. They're on television on a lot of cable channels here. New Japan World attracts a lot of subscribers from the United States. More than ever, fans here in the United States are interested in New Japan. It's not so much as a niche crowd that it had been in years past, where it was a very small vocal fan base for them. What do you think of the overall style of professional wrestling from Japan, and do you think that today's product is more closely resembling what professional wrestling was like in this country years ago, or do you think it is a little more symbolic of what pro wrestling today is?
I think it's a combination of both. I think Okada is as great as anybody out there today, and when he comes out to defend his belt for New Japan, it feels like a championship. It feels like a sport. It feels serious. You know, when Brock Lesnar wrestles Kane, a guy in a Halloween mask, it doesn't quite feel the same to me. New Japan, again, for $8.50 or whatever it is, New Japan World, to have the pleasure of watching some of the greatest wrestlers in the world live, you know, it's an incredible bargain, actually. And I think when people see a match like Okada and Omega, which is a 5-star match, you know, it's just going to blow away a Randy Orton going through the motions, or The Miz talking through most of his time on TV. It's just a whole different level. Now, AJ Styles is on that level. AJ Styles, I saw AJ Styles and Nakamura in New Japan at Wrestle Kingdom, and it, you know, it's unbelievable. So I think at WrestleMania, if they give it enough time, that's going to steal the show. I don't think anything's going to touch AJ Styles and Nakamura. But look, I understand WWE's made more for the kids, maybe the teens, but the endless, inane, stilted promos and interviews and ridiculous angles and endless commercials and commercials in the middle of matches, it really takes away from it. And I would say on a 3-hour Raw in general, you're going to have about 20 minutes of good wrestling, whereas on a New Japan card, it's the exact opposite. Maybe you'll have 20 minutes of comedy on a New Japan card, and the rest is all wrestling. So it's more old school, but, you know, you'll get a guy like Will Ospreay doing all the high spots and everything, which is very modern and really ahead of its time. And I'm an old school fan, and I think when a Will Ospreay wrestles a Ricochet, it's art. I think it's tremendous. You know, you may have a little suspension of disbelief, but, you know, it does seem a little more choreographed, but these guys are tremendous athletes, and, you know, you just kind of go wow when they're doing move after move after move. So I think the suspension of disbelief when the Undertaker, you know, just suddenly gets up after being pummeled like nothing happened to him, or Hulk Hogan, you know, suddenly, you know, gets up, you know, like Superman. There's always suspension of disbelief. So I happen to think New Japan's the finest promotion in the world right now, and which doesn't mean everything's automatically five stars. You know, some people mark out for them too, and it's kind of overkill. Like I saw on Alive this morning, late last night, early this morning, Ring of Honor meets New Japan, and it was a very, very good card, but I wouldn't say it was great. It wasn't Wrestle Kingdom great, but it was certainly worth seeing. It was certainly worth seeing, and it's wrestling elevated to an art. Kenny Omega, you know, and Okada and guys like that, you can't touch them. You know, very few could touch him. And AJ Styles can, but there's very few others.
At this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I know he has some questions also, so I'm going to turn things to him for a bit.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Sungai. Hello, Evan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Evan, my first question is, were you born and raised in Brooklyn? And did you turn out for high school sports in Brooklyn?
I was born in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, in the turbulent 60s and 70s. And I wrote a book called Apartment 4B, like in Brooklyn, a 50 short story collection about growing up in a tough, tough neighborhood. And no, I didn't try out for high school sports. I was more of a serious student than an athlete, although we played a lot of street sports back then, you know, stickball and handball and all of that, which is also mentioned in the book. But no, I was not a high school athlete.
Wow, now that Flatbush area was pretty rough, and it was known to have quite a few gangs.
That's true, yeah.
Were the Mau Maus and the Latin Kings active at the time you were growing up, the Mau Maus?
Well, I was not involved in gang activity. I was more involved in trying to get away from these guys. So I don't have great expertise in the various gangs, although I could tell you that on one occasion we were playing baseball in Prospect Park and a gang jumped us and was beating me unmercifully, and I rolled down a mountain to escape them, and I couldn't tell you which gang it was. All I could tell you was I was getting punched in the face pretty furiously. I'm laughing now. It wasn't funny at the time.
Well, no, that could have a detrimental effect on your health.
Yeah, especially rolling down the mountain to get away from them, which was probably as painful as the punches themselves, yeah.
Now I'm going to take a wild shot here. Was the gang that attacked you called the Ducky Boy?
I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of.
Because, Evan, myself, I had a rough period when I was growing up in the 70s, late 70s. I belonged to a gang called the Venti Lattes. We were named after a coffee.
Wow. Wow, that doesn't sound too intimidating, but okay.
No. I mean, we tried to escort old ladies across the street against their will, and they usually hit us with their umbrellas.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's rough. Okay. Yeah.
Well, Evan, I listened to your interview with a podcast called Wrestling Epicenter, number 38. I think I got that right, where you were on a show called Wrestling Epicenter, number 38.
I've done probably 100 interviews, especially right after The Wrestler came out. So I honestly couldn't tell you, but if you say so, I believe it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, have you ever had a one-on-one interview with a podcast you were running with Johnny Valent or maybe Bruno Sammartino where you sat down one-on-one right across from
you? I've interviewed Bruno. I've interviewed Johnny Valent. I've interviewed most of the legends. I did Legends Radio for about 10 years on the internet, and tragically, our engineer, Rick Hendrickson, just passed 6 months ago, age 34. He had an aneurysm and passed. So we were early internet radio guys, and Rick Hendrickson was a pioneer. And, yes, I've interviewed Bruno. I've interviewed Johnny Valent. Johnny Valiant's a personal friend.
Oh, okay. Now, where is he residing these days, Johnny Valent?
He's in Queens, New York also.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, did you ever have an interview, a one-on-one interview with Roddy Piper?
By phone. Yes, by phone.
Oh, how'd that go? Was he pretty animated?
Yeah. Roddy was great. You know, it's funny. I've been involved in wrestling in various capacities for decades now, and I don't often mark out, but Roddy Piper, I was like, wow, it's Roddy Piper. You know, Roddy Piper, if you saw him live, say, 1984, 85 at the Garden at his heel peak, it was unbelievable. I tell people this all the time. It was like a tornado hit the ring, and 8, 10, 12, 14 minutes later, whatever it was like you could breathe again. You could go, wow. You know, the guy was so phenomenal. And I can't, for the life of me, wrap my head around the fact that Piper and Snooker are gone. Because those two guys were so charismatic, so great together in the ring, at the Garden, or wherever they wrestled. You know, it was like, I can't wrap my head around the fact that Dusty Rhodes is gone. I used to see Dusty Rhodes and Billy Graham at the Garden. And it's very hard to really imagine. Some people just had so much charisma, it was off the charts. Bruno had a different kind of charisma. There was no entrance music back then, no pyro, no nothing. Bruno would come out in a plain pair of black tights or whatever, walk down the aisle, and the building would vibrate. The building would vibrate. Just on, like, they loved the guy so much. It was like you know, just like a folk hero, you know. You had to physically be there to imagine it. Madison Square Garden would literally shake when some of these guys walked down the aisle. They were so charismatic. And today, you know, everybody has a six-pack of abs, and they all look like $1 million, but some of these beer-bellied guys, like a Dick Murdoch, a Pat Patterson, were so unbelievably great, a Ray Stevens. You know, you don't need to look great. You don't need to look great to be great.
Yeah, I'm going to lump Dusty Rhodes into that category. Yes.
Yeah, I saw Dusty Rhodes wrestle Harley Race at the Garden. You know, Dusty Rhodes was amazing. And I used to go down to Philly and Baltimore for the NWA all the time back in the 80s. And, you know, Dusty was always wrestling Flair and Tully Blanchard and the Horsemen. And Dusty was you know, it's funny, you know, looking back, a lot of the sheet guys, now they'd be internet guys, they were down on him. Oh, the Dusty finish, the screw job finish. Dusty always put himself over. But Dusty was great. He deserved to be put over, you know?
Yes. Oh, well, now, do you know at one time Roddy Piper was ranked as one of the best 25 bagpipe players in the country?
Yeah, Dusty, Roddy came down the aisle at the Garden with the bagpipes, and he could legitimately play. And one of his earliest appearances at the Garden before he was a big star, I heard I don't remember who, but it was one of the heel managers, the Wizard or Lou, Captain Lou, or one of those guys. They or Blassie or a combination. They stuffed the bagpipes full of something, so he came out and he couldn't play them. They ribbed them. Yeah. So, yeah, true story. Look that up. Yeah.
Now, do you yourself play a musical instrument?
None whatsoever, and I have two left feet, and I can't sing either. It's like I'm good at what I'm good at, and I'm bad at what I'm at everything else. So.
Well, Evan, did anyone ever tell you your voice reminds people of Marky Ramone, drummer for the Ramones?
Well, the Ramones are out of Forest Hills, New York, and I'm a lifelong New Yorker, so it kind of makes sense. Yeah.
Did you ever?
Nobody ever told me that, though, but I could go to California. I could go anywhere. I could go to England, and they go, "You're from New York." They could tell in 1 second. But
yeah, it's kind of I've got to do it myself. I have to do a study between the differences of the dialects or accents between Queens and the Bronx and Boston. That's what I'd like to do.
So where, you guys are out of Boston?
Oh, no, we're in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, Pacific Northwest, okay, okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you guys see Piper in his prime, or you're too young? Piper was in the Northwest forever before he hit big with Don Owen.
Well, yes, I used to watch Portland wrestling a long time ago, back in the 70s, when wrestling was on, Portland wrestling. That was huge.
Yeah, Piper was a big star, yeah.
Yes. Now, Evan, did you ever have a chance to see the Ramones at the famous Bowery nightclub, CBGB's?
I never saw the Ramones, but I did go to CBGB's, and actually, it was a dump, but it was a legendary dump, and great people came out of it. Yeah, I've been to CBGB's, but unfortunately,
yeah,
I did bump into one of the Ramones at a record store. I forget which one, ages ago, and I was shocked that the guy just loved R&B like I do, and we just started talking about R&B, not even rock, and I just bumped into the guy. We just started talking. We were in a record store. Yeah.
Oh, well, now, did he have kind of like a serious demeanor to him? Because that would be the guitarist, Johnny Ramone.
No, he was very friendly. And, you know, it's funny, when a lot of times with celebrities, you know, if it's not like marking out about them and you just talk about something that they're passionate about, like, you know, just like two human beings connecting, it works out far better. So he happened to love R&B, and we just started, and that's my thing. I'm more an R&B, jazz, and blues guy. So that's because I grew up in a black neighborhood. So basically, we connected on that level. It was a good experience. Same thing with Southside Johnny. Guy loves R&B.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Evan, I enjoyed you speaking on that interview, how your interview went well with a New York wrestler named Lowlife Louie Ramos.
I love Lowlife Louie. He's my buddy. I know this guy forever. And we're like the odd couple. Like Louie, like, will bleed buckets. And, you know, I'll come into I do a radio show out of New York. I'll come in a suit and tie. we're buddies forever. And he is so charismatic and such a great talker. And he loves hardcore wrestling. He's a serious hardcore wrestler. But even, you know, in a straight wrestling match, the guy's charisma is off the charts. And he's not a kid anymore. You know, I'm sorry he never got like a national following, because he deserved it with that kind of charisma. I mean, you're never going to confuse him with, you know, Dynamite Kid or, you know, or Tiger Mask or whomever, but the guy's got unbelievable charisma.
Now, would you say he would remind most people of the Nasty Boys' Brian Knobbs?
his hero was Hulk Hogan, believe it or not. He had that kind of, when he was a face, that was his kind of deal. He would, you know, do the Superman comeback, and you know, it wasn't pretty, but he knew how to work that crowd. He's still out there. He's still wrestling, not as frequently, but he's had some serious injuries. You know, that hardcore takes its toll on you.
Oh yeah, I'm sure he's had his share of back injuries and disc injuries.
Back and front and side, he's had plenty of injuries. Yeah, but good guy. I consider him a friend.
Oh, okay. Low life Louis Raymond.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something that people don't know about Louis, and he doesn't get credit. When we did The Wrestler, he advised us when we were doing that hardcore scene, you know, with Necro Butcher. He was telling us about various gimmicks that he bought, and they even wrote a scene in where they went to the store to buy some gimmicks for the hardcore match. So that was based on Low Life Louis, you know, advising us. So he deserves some credit for the Wrestler. We thank them in the credits, but I'm just saying that's not widely known.
Oh, now if I remember right, wasn't a stapler involved in that hardcore scene? A stapler.
Yes, it was. Yes, and I'll tell you a funny Necro Butcher story. I brought him in. I said he'd be perfect, you know, in the role, and he's late. He's late. We're waiting. Necro Butcher's mother calls. His mother calls, you know. Where's my Dylan? Is he okay? I'm like, we're waiting for him. You know, can you imagine this guy like mutilates himself in the ring, one of the toughest guys in the world. His mom's calling to see if he's okay. So Aronofsky actually leaves because Necro Butcher's like an hour and a half, 2 hours late. So, finally, he gets there. He had been caught in terrible traffic. He drove for like 8 or 9 hours, and we're frantically calling Darren, come back, he's here. And Darren came back, and they hit it off, and the rest is history. Necro Butcher was great in that. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the rumors out here in the Northwest was that Low Life Louis Ramos recommended that hardcore scene use a red swing line stapler, the kind that they had in the movie The Office. Is that true?
That may be true. I wasn't there for every minute of every meeting. You know, it may very well be true. Like I said, Louis advised us on the hardcore stuff, so it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
All right. Well, Evan, one of my favorite stand-up comedy teams was the team of Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji. My question is, if you chose to go on the road and do a stand-up comedy, how well could a Evan Ginsberg, Johnny Valiant team do? How would you do?
Well, I'd obviously be the straight man. And basically, when we did our shows, I would be like the MC and introduce them. So that was basically the role that I played anyway. Let me just say something about Morocco. I was there for Morocco's Intercontinental Championship run and for his matches with Backlund. And Don Morocco, at that period, was as great a heel as ever lived. That guy was so great. So great. I was there the night that Snuka jumped off the cage on him, and I think that was probably the most exciting moment I've ever seen in pro wrestling, because people forget that really wasn't done back then. So Snuka gets on top of the cage, and instead of jumping down, he actually leaps up. He actually leaps up, and like 1,000 flash cubes go off. That was in, you know, the old school camera days, and it was unbelievable. And Morocco, you know, Morocco was just an incredible heel and a great talker. you know, as well. And he came back as a face years later, and he was nowhere near as good. I don't think Piper was as good as a face either, but heel Morocco, early to mid-80s, Intercontinental champion, unbelievable. I mean, as great. In fact, there were many nights that people were more interested and into his match than Backlund's. Backlund was great with a great technical wrestler. You put Backlund in with a Greg Valentine, a Bob Orton, a Morocco. You put Backlund in with somebody who could actually wrestle, and Backlund was great. But Backlund could not carry the big lumbering guys. You know, Flair could carry anybody. Backlund couldn't. So, but Morocco, anybody you put him in, you know, it was just tremendous, and it felt like a meaningful championship. Today, WWE has, you know, 10 different championships, and the vast majority of them you could care less. They're almost meaningless. So, but I love Morocco.
Well, do you yourself have a picture of the snooker dive in Madison Square Garden?
I could top that. I have a picture of snooker diving on Morocco signed by snooker. I knew snooker. So that was an incredible moment.
Hey, that's not a bad piece of.
You know what Lanny Poffo told me? He told me that snooker was doing that in the territories. He was doing that jump off of cages. But that was the first time it was on a large scale like that, where, you know, people actually, you know, back then a lot of it, you know, you'd be at a little house show somewhere and nobody was capturing it on film. So it's lost to history. But when he did it at the Garden, boy, snooker was tremendous in his prime. A lot of these guys, you know, again, if you wrestle 350 days, it takes a toll on you eventually. Sergeant Slaughter in that period was unbelievable, and 5 years later slowed down considerably. You know, you're thousands of matches later, and you're older, and you know, the road wears you down and everything else. So, but so a lot of these guys in their prime, and they were something. Pat Patterson was amazing.
Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, even though you've wrestled a lot of days on the road, the adrenaline takes hold, and sometimes wrestlers hit a little bit harder than they intend to, and that takes a toll. Yes.
Well, I used to see Flair and Steamboat, and they would chop each other so much that they'd bleed sometimes. I mean, you know, wrestlers hate the word fake. You know, they'll tell you, you know, my hip replacement wasn't fake. My bad back wasn't fake. My divorces weren't fake, you know, et cetera, so on. So, you know, and that's what our movie 350 Days is about, the toll that the business took on these guys. And, you know, it's a rough business. And I tell people time and time again, and one of my pet peeves is, you know, wrestling fans will react badly to it. I'm like, it's a disgrace that a McMahon with billions of dollars doesn't give 401ks and pensions and health benefits to these guys and women who sacrificed their bodies for him. You know, so now they're wrestling 250 days instead of 350. Believe me, it still takes its toll. You meet up with some of these guys when they're in their 50s and 60s, and they're lucky if they could, you know, take their jacket, you know, on and off from the arthritis that kicks in. And, you know, those bumps take their tolls. You know, some of the rings are very hard. It's brutal on the body. People don't understand. They really don't understand the business. They, you know, I love Vince. I love Vince. Well, tell Vince to give the guys some benefits, you know. Maybe I'd have a better opinion of them.
Well, Evan, I enjoyed your comment about Vince Russo and how his Monday Night Raw and Thursday Night SmackDown series has a tendency to cater to the lowest common denominator, and the titles that they put up don't mean as much as in the days of Jack Briscoe or maybe a Wahoo McDaniels. My question is, have you seen the movie Lipstick and Dynamite?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was at the premiere in New York, and a lot of the legendary, you know, female wrestlers were there. Moolah and Mae Young, and a lot of them were there. A lot of them are gone now. This was a while ago. But, yeah, you know, the titles today, it's almost ridiculous. They'll go, Randy Orton is an 8-time world champion or whatever. And I'm like, I don't remember one title win or one title loss. But people still tell you about the time Ivan Koloff pinned Bruno and the garden went silent in shock because it meant so much. You know, they go, John Cena is a whatever, 14-time champion, whatever he is, 15, 14. And I'm like, all I remember is Cena wrestling, you know, Randy Orton 250 times. I don't remember one title win, one title loss. It's a meaningless blur. You know, titles, Ring of Honor does it right. Ring of Honor and New Japan do it right. The guy will be the champion for a year and change. And it means something when the title changes. It's like if you just change it on TV every couple of weeks to pop a rating, then it's just the TV match. You know, I couldn't, like I said, I hate to be repetitive because it's radio, but I couldn't tell you one John Cena or Randy Orton title win or title loss. I couldn't. If you put $1 million in front of me, all I remember is these guys wrestling each other ad nauseum. That's all I could tell you.
Oh, okay. All right, well, Evan, I have a poster from that movie, Lipstick and Dynamite, that is signed by all of the main ladies in the cast, the Fabulous Moolah, the great Mae Young, Gladys Killam-Gillam,
yeah.
Ida Mae Martinez.
Yeah, I met all of them, and I actually got friendly with Ida Mae. She's a nice woman. She passed, but they all passed from what I remember, or the majority of them, not all, the majority, yeah.
Well, I may have to trade that signed wrestling poster for your autographed snooka dive in the garden. Trade.
you never know. I doubt it, but the snooka thing has that was magic, man. That was magic, and you know, Mick Foley was in the audience that night. He said that changed his life. You know.
Yeah. Well, Evan, you commented to Sign Guy how expensive the WWE tickets have become. My question is, how is the New York roller derby scene, and is this an alternative that you sometimes take advantage of, the roller derby scene?
I loved roller derby with the New York Chiefs and Chief John Parker and all those guys back in the day. We used to think of roller derby as wrestling on wheels. Basically, they'd have the match races, which was basically a fight. And but you know, it's ironic because now roller derby is a shoot. It's legit, and I don't find it quite as entertaining. I mean, it's a legitimate sport now, and I don't know. To me, it's just not quite as entertaining as the old school, wrestling on wheels, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed it very much.
Are there any truths to the rumors out here in the Northwest that you are going to recruit low-life Louis Ramos into the roller derby scene? Are those rumors true?
There's no truth whatsoever. I don't even know if Louis can skate. I don't know. But, Louis would have a good, like, hardcore match on roller skates. You know, he's a genius with that stuff. Louis Ramos and Homicide down at the Doghouse, which Bobby Lombardi was the late, great promoter at the Doghouse in Brooklyn. And Louis Ramos and Homicide would have Christmas death matches where they would have a big Christmas tree with wrapped gifts, and inside the packages would be weapons that they'd mutilate each other with. Lowlife Louie and Homicide. So Homicide made it. Homicide's, TNA and Japan, and Homicide really made it. And he was a local kid, so we're very proud of him.
Oh, okay. Jeez, all right. Well, Evan, Sign Guy and myself are assembling a cast of Northwest wrestlers to a casting call, if you will, and we are putting on a community play called The Return of Hogan's Heroes. We have Sign Guy himself playing LeBeau, the French cook. My question is, if you assembled a cast of New York wrestlers or wrestlers that you have interviewed, would Cindy Lopner play the role of Secretary Hilga? Yourself, yes.
Cindy Lauper is very, I interviewed her. She's very charismatic, very bubbly. It's kind of like when you see her on TV, that's really her. She's very outgoing, friendly, and she's done some acting. I think she could do any kind of theater or whatever. I saw her live about a year ago. She opened for Rod Stewart, and she's still great. She has a big, booming voice and tremendous live performer, and she blew Rod Stewart off the stage.
Wow. All right. Okay. So I'm going to – all right. I'm going to put her down as playing Secretary Hilga.
Yeah.
Would you be comfortable in the role of Major Hochstetter yourself?
Yeah, I've done some acting. I could handle it. I'll tell you a funny acting story. I was on the set of The Wrestler, you know, as a producer, just watching, you know, hanging out, and Aronofsky gets the smirk, and he goes, "Evan, come here." And I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, this was the autograph scene where it was very sad because nobody turned out, and he goes, "Evan, I want you to talk to all the wrestlers, walk up to Mickey last, ask him for an autograph and a Polaroid." So Mickey comes over, whispers in my ear. He goes, "Just improv it." He thinks I'm an actor. I'm not an actor, okay? So there's like 125 people on the set, giant cameras. And next thing you know, I'm acting. So I'm just making it up on the spot. And I say to him what I would, like any wrestling legend. I go, "I loved you as a kid. I saw you at the Garden. You know, could I have your autograph?" And he goes, "What's your name?" And I think for a second, and I go, "Evan." So I'm playing myself in a fictional movie. If you ever see it again, it's surreal. It's surreal. So that's I must have gotten 200 calls, emails. "Was that you in the movie?" I go, "Obviously," you know. So, yeah, that's my 30 seconds of immortality right there.
No, all right.
And
okay,
I'm in,
well,
and if you ever see the trailer, I'm in the trailer also. So my acting debut, I'm acting with a Golden Globe winner for Best Actor and an Academy Award nominee. I mean, it's surreal. You have a better chance of winning the lotto or getting hit by lightning. I mean, there are actors that work their whole lives that never have an opportunity like that. And it just fell in my lap. So a friend of mine in the business goes, "That was a gift to you." And I go, "Yeah, absolutely. 100 years from now, I'll be long gone and people will be watching it, and there I'll be." It is. It's a gift.
Wow. Well, that was a very good story, and I'll have to watch that. And Evan, it's been very nice talking with you, and at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Sun Guy.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, QT. Well, Mr. Ginsburg, we have just a few moments left, so I want to give you ample time. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners today, if you want to plug and promote absolutely anything, upcoming projects, social medias, your favorite delicatessen, anything it might be, floor is all yours.
Thanks so much. Many years ago, we did a documentary called Wrestling Then and Now, which basically followed me around. We went to Nikolai Volkov's house, and we met Killer Kowalski and Homicide and my late great friend Tiger Khan and Don Dr. Death Arnold, all these great, great, you know, legends. And that's available on Amazon Prime. And also we have 350 Days, the documentary, coming out shortly, which We'll be making major announcements about that, starring Bret Hart and superstar Billy Graham. You can listen to the Evan Ginsberg Show at VillageConnectionRadio.com. That's VillageConnectionRadio.com. Sunday mornings, 11 a.m. That's New York time. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else. That's pretty much it. Those are my upcoming, projects. And, please come out and support 350 Days when it comes out, because it's very special and heartfelt. And it's like yin and yang. Superstar Billy Graham is, this guy could read the phone book and it's charismatic. And Bret Hart is very, very reflective and honest and serious in the film. And the thing just works, and we're very excited about it. So we urge you to support it when it comes out. It's not a piece of fluff. It's a very serious film. We've spent 5 years on it. 350 Days, it's called.
Well, I look forward to that when it gets released to the public. And I want to thank you very much for taking time today to be with us. We appreciate it greatly. Well, fans, once 350 Days hits, make sure you check that out. It should be an outstanding documentary. If you haven't seen The Wrestler before, go get a copy, check it out from the library, buy it at a DVD store, whatever you have to do, get a copy, watch it. It was an outstanding movie, and we will be back with you Sunday afternoon. One of our local SCW photographers / producers going to be with us. Asher Garcia is going to be the guest. Should be a great time with him. We will talk to you on Sunday.